about suicide. That's right. The choice to take one's own life. And we want to dispel some myths. We want to give you some facts. We're not going to take sides on the issue, philosophically or morally. We want to give you a range of thoughts on that. Why do people commit suicide? There's a number of reasons. And one is because, and people think primarily it's because of an emotional mood, a sadness, sometimes called depression. And we'll talk about that and present the issues as we've discovered them in our research over the last week. We're going to begin with one of the saddest songs I've ever known. Maybe we can, those of us who are happy, can begin to understand some of the difficulties if we explore at least the mood of such ultimate sadness. Frank Sinatra here.
Heaven's boundless arch I see spread out above me. Oh, what a distant drear to one who loves.
Suicide, Fact and Foolishness. That's the name of the show until the end of this hour. Jay Koronek with you for WHFR, saving Detroit's airways, and maybe we're saving some people's lives. Maybe we're giving some people hope. Maybe we're just explaining what is going on here. A special program all hour on suicide. As we said, we're calling it fact and foolishness. Let's just explore some of the myths and facts. If you were listening to Mike's Alternative Diner earlier this morning, we went over some of these, but people have a lot of misconceptions. First of all, are there more suicides than homicides? What do you think? Wrong. There are more suicides. It's the fourth largest cause of death. More men commit suicide than women. True or false? That's true. More men do commit suicide than women by a vast amount. If a person really wants to kill him or herself, no one has the right to stop him or her. True or false? Well, of course, that gets into personal issues of personal freedom. Someone said in the research I've read that the ultimate civil right is the right to end your own life. And certainly there are some reasons that a majority of you, our listeners, would even agree to. For example, assisted suicide or suicide in a situation of terrible terminal illness, pain and suffering. Euthanasia was one term for it in the past. I haven't heard that recently, but a majority of people are in favor of allowing doctor-assisted death, suicide, if you will. Most suicides are caused by a single dramatic and traumatic event. No, not true. It's a number of things. Who's to say at the final moment what the issue might be? It's unhelpful to talk about suicide to a person who is depressed. True or false? Well, that's false. In fact, if you know how to do it, if you know what you're doing, then absolutely it is a good idea. It is a good idea to discuss suicidal issues. One reason that people claim they commit suicide is because of stress in their life and their jobs. Usually it's grief or loss of one sort or another. I mean, if you had to say there are a number of factors, of course. Nothing is that simple. But let's get into the pressure mood with a song from Billy Joel that I'm sure you're all familiar with.
Face, and you cannot handle pressure. does it mean?
Billy Joel song, Pressure. No Peter Pan advice in this show. Special edition of WHFR Journal, saving Detroit's airways and maybe some lives. Suicide, fact, and foolishness. What we're not talking about in this show, not mentioning at all, is suicide caused by clinical depression. Okay. A lot of people think, well, anyone who's down or blue or sad, they're in danger of suicide. Not true. Not true at all. Okay? By itself, a simple moodiness, or even describe it as blackness of a very short duration, is normal. Yeah. Life naturally has its problems. And if you're mentally ill, if you have a mental illness, that's something different, okay? And it is called, in general, depression. Although, specifically, it should be called clinical depression, a very, very serious blackness, let's say. William Styron, the novelist, 1940s, 1950s novelist, has described his bout with clinical depression in an essay. Mike Wallace, the 60 Minute reporter, has described his difficulties with clinical depression over the last 15, 20 years. And believe me, if you are clinically depressed, you know it. It is, as William Styron called it, a brainstorm, not a creative problem-solving moment, but a storm in your brain. It is a pit, an abyss of blackness. And if you are in that situation, you know it. If it is like that and you have been like that for a while, then you need help and you have to get help and you are sick and this is not something that is that allows you a choice. Okay, you are not in control of your destiny if you feel that way. You need not only to talk to others, but you need to talk to doctors, to medical professionals. Now, there is a suicide prevention hotline. We'll give out that number. That is not the only answer. That is not necessarily the best answer. But they are people to talk to. 313-224-7000. Suicide prevention hotline. They'll talk to you. Okay? But if you have this melancholia, this extended period of blackness, of a storm in your brain, and have no hope or desire to continue, that is not what we are going to be talking about in the rest of this show. You are obviously sick and you know it. You are not acting normally. You are not feeling normally, and you need medical assistance. And there is medical assistance. You will feel much better after you get some help, some professional help. We're not talking about psychotherapy alone. We're not talking about someone who is going to tell you how to live your life. We're talking about somebody who will redirect your diet, your exercise, and maybe, yes, you do need some medication. Often, to come out of an illness, you need some kind of medication. We're not talking happy pills here. So if you are one of the very few that have clinical depression, although I understand it will happen to 1 in 10. Clinical depression happens to 1 in 10 of us sometime in our life. You need help, and you need professional help. and you know it, and get it, and please, it is not something you can pull yourself out of. But what are the danger signals of suicide? Because, by the way, folks, most suicides, according to the numbers, happen by people who are not clinically depressed. They are not suffering from mental illness. That's right. They are in control of their destiny. Well, here are the danger signals. So you can either see if you fit the pattern of the majority of people who commit suicide, not because you should, but because you might want to make another choice, a better choice, a choice that will give you choices after that. Or these danger signals are also clues to friends, relatives who might want to intercede. Number one, past history of attempted suicide. This is the strongest predictor of suicide. If someone has attempted it before, they may attempt it again. Although 80% of those who have tried it once don't like it and will not try it again. But successful suicides do result from previous attempts at suicide. Also, suicidal ideation, talk, or preparation are all strong predictors of suicide. If someone suggests that they're considering it, they don't want to go on anymore, they don't want to live anymore, that's the number one indicator. And your response, well, we'll get to that. Number two, certain psychiatric problems like clinical depression or hopelessness, schizophrenia, which is a medical problem, a medical illness, a mental illness, can be diagnosed. Substance abuse, no doubt about this one. That's a psychiatric problem. Alcoholism or drug abuse, you certainly don't want to commit suicide. If you've been drinking too much, if you've been taking either prescription or non-prescription drugs and you feel awful, that's the drugs, folks. That's not you. That's the drugs. In fact, William Styron, who went through his clinical depression, it actually happened when he stopped drinking after 40 years of abusing it. When he stopped drinking, when his body said, we can't take this anymore, his moods shifted into the blackest of black moods. Maybe it's one of those, you know, withdrawal things. So either stopping abusing of drugs or the abuse of drugs themselves, they alter your mind. And you can't make a decision that's worth anything that really proves who you are and what you are. You have to get clean. You have to get sober. And if you see someone, of course, who's abusing substances like that, then you know that they're more prone to consider that final choice. Personality disorder, especially borderline or antisocial disorders, it could be an indicator. Number three here, situational risk factors are danger signals of suicide. Stressful life events like death of a loved one or recent loss of employment, or loss or disruption of normal social support networks, for example, divorce, unemployment, or migration, you know, changing your environment to a brand new one. That's very upsetting, actually. Also, absent or inadequate social support networks. This often develops from other risk factors such as recent stressful pressure life events, or leads to risk factors such as clinical depression. Number four, contagion. The contagion hypothesis suggests that exposure to suicide or suicidal behavior by others may be a risk factor for suicide. It is amazing to me, in preparing this report for you, how many people have considered suicide seriously, or who have attempted it, or how many people are connected to us who have. I had a cousin about 20 years ago who... supposedly, a nice family, a couple of loving kids, loving husband. She was a cousin of mine, but she committed suicide. She chose suicide. We don't know if she was clinically depressed or not. We don't think so. Were there some signs? She was a distant cousin. I didn't know of any of these danger signals. One of the transmitter operators here at WHFR. Her brother chose suicide. He was young. And that is the number one cause of death, by the way, of people age 15 to 25 taking their own lives. Boy, there's a contradiction for you, isn't it? People young with all their lives ahead of them, all their years of life ahead of them, and it's the number one cause of death. Although, if you are a black male living in an urban setting, the number one cause of death will not be suicide, it will be a homicide. Ideation, talk, or preparation are all strong predictors of suicide. If someone suggests that they're considering it, they don't want to go on anymore, they don't want to live anymore, that's the number one indicator. And your response, well, we'll get to that. Number two, certain psychiatric problems like clinical depression or hopelessness, schizophrenia, which is a medical problem, a medical illness, a mental illness, can be diagnosed. Substance abuse, no doubt about this one. That's a psychiatric problem. Alcoholism or drug abuse, you certainly don't want to commit suicide. If you've been drinking too much, if you've been taking either prescription or non-prescription drugs and you feel awful, that's the drugs, folks. That's not you. That's the drugs. In fact, William Styron, who went through his clinical depression, it actually happened when he stopped drinking after 40 years of abusing it. When he stopped drinking, when his body said, we can't take this anymore, his moods shifted into the blackest of black moods. Maybe it's one of those, you know, withdrawal things. So either stopping abusing of drugs or the abuse of drugs themselves, they alter your mind and you can't make a decision that's worth anything that really proves who you are and what you are. You have to get clean. You have to get sober. And if you see someone, of course, who's abusing substances like that, then you know that they're more prone to consider that final choice. Personality disorder, especially borderline or antisocial disorders, it could be an indicator. Number three here, situational risk factors are danger signals of suicide. Stressful life events like death of a loved one or recent loss of employment. Or loss or disruption of normal social support networks, for example, divorce, unemployment, or migration. You know, changing your environment to a brand new one. That's very upsetting, actually. Also, absent or inadequate social support networks. This often develops from other risk factors such as recent stressful pressure life events or leads to risk factors such as clinical depression. Number four, contagion. The contagion hypothesis suggests that exposure to suicide or suicidal behavior by others may be a risk factor for suicide. It is amazing to me in preparing this report for you how many people have considered suicide seriously or who have attempted it, or how many people are connected to us who have. I had a cousin about 20 years ago who supposedly a nice family, a couple of loving kids, loving husband. She was a cousin of mine, but she committed suicide. She chose suicide. We don't know if she was clinically depressed or not. We don't think so. Were there some signs? She was a distant cousin. I didn't know of any of these danger signals. One of the transmitter operators here at WHFR, her brother, chose suicide. He was young. And that is the number one cause of death, by the way, of people age 15 to 25 taking their own lives. Boy, there's a contradiction for you, isn't it? People young with all their lives ahead of them, all their years of life ahead of them, and it's the number one cause of death. Although, if you are a black male living in an urban setting, the number one cause of death will not be suicide, it will be a homicide. Somebody, a friend of yours, someone you know, will shoot you. That is the number one most likely cause of death for urban black males. But in general, age 15 to 25, the cause of death is suicide. That isn't the biggest category, though. Interestingly, it's white males age 65 to 75. And almost 80% of the suicides are male. So there's the contagion factor. Number six, genetic predisposition. Individuals who attempt or complete suicide often have a significant family history of suicidal behaviors that we've talked about already. Two studies suggest a genetically based risk for suicide that may be inherited independently of major psychiatric illness. And we're not certain about that. Gee, if we could find that, Nate at the cyber, thanks to the Cyber Cafe info booth that Mike's Alternative Diner was suggesting, wouldn't it be great if we could discover that gene, that part of the DNA chain that might give a predisposition to a suicide, we'll just take it out. Are we removing some aspect of free choice here? But it does seem that there's some relationship there. It's probably just cultural, behavioral. Neurotransmitters. A clear relationship has been demonstrated between low concentrations of the serotonin metabolite 5-hydroxynucleic acid fluid, and that fluid is in cerebrospinal. It's a cerebrospinal fluid, and that might mean something. They don't know why, but that there's low concentrations of this serotonin complex in brain spinal fluid, and that they found in psychiatric patients. Of course, those are people who definitely are in trouble clinically, medically. Ready accessibility of firearms. The United States has one of the highest suicide rates in the world because we choose the most violent weapons, and we have these weapons all around. So if somebody commits suicide as an impulse, first of all, it's a bad impulse, because after that impulse, there's no other impulses. Okay? You want to lead an impulsive life? You want to be spontaneous? Well, unfortunately, after suicide, you can't be spontaneous anymore. Okay? So you're not affirming spontaneity here by making this choice. And the problem with having a firearm around, a handgun or a rifle, I understand it's difficult with rifles because that trigger is so far away. Can hardly reach it. But because they're so readily available, we have more successful suicides in the U.S. Whereas people that use pills or some other technique, it's usually not as likely that you will die from it. As I say here, firearm suicides often are immediately fatal, leaving minimal opportunity for post-attempt rescue. Okay. Those are suicide facts. And the number one way, our surveys show, the number one way to help, to intercede, and we're going to listen to a song here, what to do if you suspect a loved one may be contemplating suicide. This is Suicide Fact and Foolishness. This is a special edition of WHFR Journal, pre-recorded, and we're going to be playing it several times during the break in place of our regular show. Jay Koronek with you, WHFR 89.3 FM from Henry Ford Community College, saving Detroit's airwaves and maybe even some lives. The number one way, the number one answer for those people contemplating suicide or those people trying to intervene is the simple fact that suicide, suicidal feeling, a decision for suicide, is able to be overcome if you'll just wait. That's right, you will survive. Just wait. Postpone that decision. Just wait. And here is Amy Grant. suggesting the same thing. Amy Grant, takes a little time sometime. Not trying to trivialize this suicide fact and foolishness. How much time could take months, more than a year even, if you're suffering grief or significant loss, a single major event along with any of those other contributing factors that we talked about earlier? Could be that it will take a little time. We're going to be suggesting now several books for you to read and to consider looking into to understand this a little better. And here's some very, it's a really a direct advice book from a fellow from Allen Park, Michigan, who's become a very, very big, significant self-help writer now these days. Peter McWilliams is his name. That's McWilliams, McWilliams. Peter McWilliams from Allen Park started off about 20 years ago as a popular poet. After Rod McEwen, there was Peter McWilliams. One of his small poetry collections was entitled How to Survive the Loss of a Love. And he has now expanded that, that collection of poems, and has included some prose, some nonfiction prose, with the help of a couple of medical doctors, psychiatrist, and a professor. And they have now expanded it. So the book is entitled How to Survive the Loss of a Love. From Bantam or Prelude Press, Peter McWilliams is the primary author. And he has 60 different suggestions here. And they're all very good and to the point. And that first point is wait. Don't do it now. Because, first of all, you may not be really understanding what's going on. And if you're feeling grief, if you're feeling loss, if you're feeling down, but it's not that blackness, it's not that melancholy of a clinical depression, understand that, as McWilliams says, you will survive. As Amy Grant suggests, it takes a little time. It takes time. And a little time, well, it may seem like forever. It may take months, it may take years, but it will pass. And here's how Peter McWilliams says it. You will get better. No doubt about it. The healing process has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Keep in mind at the beginning that there is an end. It's not that far off. You will heal. Nature is on your side. Your body wants to heal. Your mind wants to heal. How do you know your body wants to heal? Your body wants to stay alive. That's why drowning is so difficult to do as a suicidal act. Because once you try to force yourself under, your body resists that. You come up gasping for air because your body wants to survive. Okay? So does your mind. You've got to give it time. Nature is a powerful ally, as McWilliams says. Tell yourself often, I am alive and I will survive. You are alive, you will survive. His second point is, if you need it, get help at once. If you think you need help, don't hesitate. Get it at once. If you're feeling suicidal or even think you might be feeling suicidal, call a suicide prevention hotline at once. In the Detroit area, that's 313-224-7000. 313-224-7000. You should also seek help at once if you feel you are coming apart, quote unquote, coming apart. If you feel that you are no longer in control, if you're about to take an action you may later regret, whether it's suicide or something else, or if you have a history of emotional disturbance, get help. Hey, it's the 90s. It's all right to ask for help. If you turn to alcohol, drugs, or other addictive substances in time of need, that's a big sign you can get help. There is help. If you feel isolated with no one to turn to, there is help out there. If you repeatedly find yourself in loss situations, is there a pattern there? Is it not just fate? Oh, I've had all these people around me die recently. Okay, well, maybe there is a reason for that. Are they all overdosing on drugs or something? That's not your fault then, is it? You need to talk to someone, and help can be found. I mentioned the suicide prevention hotline, but help can be found of all places in the Yellow Pages. Explore the organizations under such listings as help lines, help phone lines, okay? You could even dial operator or 911, and they'll give you some information. This is not the time to be brave, so-called. and to, quote, go it alone, unquote. In fact, it takes a great deal of courage to ask for help. Number three, suggestions from Peter McWilliams, acknowledge the loss. Again, the most significant single cause of a suicide is a significant loss. Something has been taken away, something is gone away, something does not exist that existed before, and that's upsetting. That's change. Change is always upsetting. Change is always difficult and uncomfortable. But from change comes the possibility, yes, to regroup and to be better. I know it doesn't seem that way short term, because you got to get past the hurt. As McWilliams says here, you may struggle to both believe and disbelieve that this could have happened to you. It has happened. It is real. Recognize that a loss has taken place. You may wonder if you're strong enough to bear such a loss. You are strong enough. You are alive. You will survive. Number four, you are not alone. Loss is part of life, of being alive, of being human. Everyone experiences loss. Everyone. Your task is to make the journey from immediate loss to eventual gain as rapidly, smoothly, and courageously as possible. Now, it's something I want to dispel here. It's definitely not the case that suicide should be perceived as a cowardly act. There's a whole nother issue that we can't go into today, and that is the response of others to the loss of someone through suicide. How do you relate or respond or understand someone's choice to die? Well, that's the problem of those that live past. Number one, you should not understand it as cowardice. Bravery or cowardice is not the issue here. The only issue is the death, the choice of self-death. Everyone experiences loss. Somehow the camaraderie of mutual suffering eases the pain. You have comrades in this, almost 6 billion on this planet, you know. Number five, it's okay to feel. It's okay to feel numb. Expect to be in shock for a while. This emotional numbness may be frightening. It's okay to feel fear. Will I make it? Will I ever love again? Will I ever feel good about anything again? These are familiar fears that follow a loss. It's okay to feel them, but to the degree that you can, don't believe them. Okay? Don't believe them. It's okay to feel nothing. Say, I feel nothing. It's okay. There are times when you'll have no feelings of any kind. That's fine. That's typical. Other people have been there. It's okay to feel anything. You may feel grief-stricken, angry, like a failure, exhausted, muddled, lost, beaten, indecisive, relieved, overwhelmed, inferior, melancholy, giddy, silly, loathful, full of self-hatred, envious, suicidal. Again, feeling suicidal is okay. Acting upon the feeling is not, as Peter McWilliams says. Disgusted, happy, outraged, enraged, or anything else. All feelings are part of the healing process. Let yourself feel. Let yourself heal. Number six, be with the pain. If you're hurting, admit it. To feel pain after a loss is normal, natural, proof that you are alive, a sign that you're able to respond to life's experiences. Although you may be frightened by it, be with your pain. Feel it. Lean into it. You will not find it bottomless. If you do, it may be that clinical depression thing. Get help right away. You can't come out of that one by yourself. And you don't want to let illness or disease do it. See, pain is not hurting, but as healing. If you don't feel that you're a part of the group, it's not necessarily bad. There are different perspectives. Here's a simple but lovely song from Jim Henson. portraying one of the Muppet characters, Rolf the Dog. Now, this song is associated, of course, with Kermit, who is also created, in the voice of Jim Henson. This version, he is being Rolf the Dog. Let's take a listen to what a change of perspective can do. A difficult, moody situation where you don't perceive yourself to be the same as everyone else or similar to everyone else.
Now here's a lovely song that Kermit the Frog usually sings. Well, he's the right color for this song. And it's not exactly that I'm the wrong color, but it's just, I'm not the color that this song is written about, so to speak. It goes like this. It's not easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves, when I think it might be nicer being red or yellow or gold or something much more colorful like that. It's not easy being green. It seems you blend in with so many other ordinary things, and people tend to pass you over because you're not standing out like flashy sparkles in the water or stars in the sky. But green's the color of spring, and green can be cool and friendly like, and green can be big like a mountain, or important like a river, or tall like a tree. When green is all there is to be, it could make you wonder why. But why wonder, I'm green and it'll do fine. It's beautiful, and I think it's what I want to be. That is, if I were Kermit the Frog.
And of course he is. Jim Henson's voice there, Rolf the Dog. A CD entitled Old Brown Ears is Back. And Jim Henson portraying Rolf the Dog in a lot of ballads. And of course the song Being Green, most closely associated with Jim Henson's character of Kermit. Yeah, see, green is makes you different, makes you separate, makes you Vulcan. Well, the original Mr. Spock in Star Trek had a green skin, but they dropped that after the first episode. The makeup was too expensive to keep doing. But the point being, you perceive a difference, you perceive the separateness. There is a different point of view. You can see it as unique, as special. And Peter McWilliams in How to Survive the Loss of a Love, talking here about suicide, fact, and foolishness. His point number 7 is, you're great. Maybe from the depths of being down or blue, not clinically depressed, it's hard to understand, but you are a good, whole, worthwhile human being. You are okay. You're more than okay. You're great. Your self-esteem may have suffered a jolt. Your thoughts may reflect some guilt, worry, condemnation, or self-deprecation. These thoughts are just symptoms of the stress that you're going through. There is no need to give negative thoughts about yourself the center of your attention. Don't punish yourself with if-onlys, you know, like, if only I had or hadn't done this or that, I wouldn't be in this emotional mess. Disregard any thoughts that begin with if-only. Look at the present. Forget about the past. Forget about it. You are right here, today. You are alive. If you are alive, you have potential for growth and change. You're much more than the emotional wound you're currently suffering. Don't lose sight of that. Beneath the surface turmoil, you are good, you are whole, you are beautiful just because you are. Just because you are. You are alive. You have the gift of life. You want to give it back? You can't give it back. You want to deny it? Think of the loss. Think of what's lost tomorrow. Even the existential philosophers who don't believe in anything, who believe the world is absurd, who don't believe there's any meaning. Albert Camus, Jean-Paul Sartre, and the others, even Kierkegaard, write about suicide as not a good choice. Choice is everything. Being alive is everything because there isn't anything else. If you choose suicide, you can never choose anything else again. You say, that's good. That relieves me a lot of pressure. Because if there is nothing, if there is no answer, no meaning, then only choice has meaning. And if you deny future choices on your own part to set examples for others, then, well, it's the wrong thing to do. It's a bad choice because there are no choices afterwards. Now, interestingly, in terms of statistics here, the group that commits suicide to the highest extent, the religious group, are Catholics. Yep, their church teaches that that's a sin. You won't go to heaven. But somehow, they don't believe that. You know how people are who are religious. They only hear certain parts of the religion and not all of it. So in terms of those who are religious, the highest percentage of those who espouse a religion of one sort or another who commit suicide are Catholics. And you would think they shouldn't be. But I've heard it's expressed, not by Catholics, is that the teachings about heaven and the wonderfulness of heaven and the life after this life, in other words, death, that Jesus promises this wonderful heaven to Catholics and to others, this life after death is so wonderful that it seems like it overpowers in the thoughts of those who consider suicide. It overpowers and gives a reason for suicide. You want to get sooner to that next great life. Very interesting. It's not agnostics. It's not atheists. It's not existentialists who are the groups that commit suicide the most. It's the religious who think there's an afterlife. So be careful of that. It's a trap. Remember, if you are Catholic, that your religion says that's not a good choice either. We have to earn heaven. If you believe in heaven, we have to earn it. We have to, as the Jehovah Witnesses say, you have to make heaven here on earth first. You have to make those good choices right here first. Pretty heavy-duty stuff. We know that suicide is not something that people like to hear talked about. And by the way, the number one thing I found from the internet that you should not say to somebody considering suicide is you should talk to them. You should take it seriously. You should ask them all about their situation, but let them talk. Use the psychoanalytic approach. Let them express themselves and work it out. What you should not say is, cheer up. You've got a lot to live for. That is the most depressing, the most awful statement to somebody who's already depressed. Why? Because it shows you do not understand what they're feeling and what they're going through. It is an insult to them. It is a distancing from them. You cannot say, cheer up. You should not say, cheer up. You've got a lot to live for. You must let them explain themselves first. So we're not saying cheer up here. We're saying talk, listen, and try to understand. As it says here, what should you do? From the American Federation for Suicide Prevention, AFSP.org. This is from the internet, www.AFSP.org. American Federation for Suicide Prevention.org for organization. What to do? What should you do? Do not attempt to argue anyone out of suicide. Rather, let the person know you care and understand that he or she is not alone, that suicidal feelings are temporary, that depression can be treated and that problems can be solved. Okay? Avoid the temptation to say you have so much to live for or your suicide will hurt the family. That is not the issue. Be actively involved in seeking professional help for this person. Since suicidal people don't often believe they can be helped, you may have to do more than just listening. For example, a suicidal college student resisted seeing a psychiatrist until his roommate offered to accompany him on the visit. Another example, a 17-year-old accompanied her 16-year-old suicidal sister to a psychiatrist because the parents refused to become involved. So don't deny this. Don't walk away. You can make a difference by helping those in need find a knowledgeable mental health professional or a reputable treatment facility. And, of course, you should follow up on that loved one's treatment if they say, yeah, I'll talk to somebody. Well, other than being willing to listen, be willing to take some action if you feel it's necessary. Definitely take it seriously. 3/4 of all suicides give some warning of their intentions to a friend or family member. Okay? Here is Amy Grant again. We're going to return to her most recent album, Behind the Eyes, which in which she's written most of the songs herself or with a colleague. And this track is pertinent here. We all have these troubles. We all have these problems. And it not only takes a little time, but we can turn this world around.
Yeah.
And we can't do that if we're not around anymore, can we? We can find some answers collectively. Take the time. This is Suicide, Fact, and Foolishness, an hour-long program produced especially here at WHFR-FM in order to save Detroit's airwaves and save some lives, we hope, too. If you're feeling suicidal, remember that there is hope out there, and there are people that care. Wait it out is the most important thing. Wait. Don't choose now. If you're in this emotional down period, because there are stages of grief. There are these stages, these recovery stages. It is documented by doctors. You will go through shock, denial, numbness after a loss or grief, and then it's preceded by fear, anger, and then depression, and then you'll begin to come out. But it will not be a slow, gradual process. It takes time, and there's ups and downs in the recovery process. You go through an understanding, an acceptance, and then finally moving on. This is documented, folks. It does work this way. So don't make that final choice after which there are no other choices. Help people who are at this point by not being judgmental, but by listening and being a close friend. If you're trying to do this alone, here are some suggestions, too. If you're trying to do it alone, why not write a journal? Write down your thoughts. Work it out. Figure it out. If you're going to choose to end it all, at least make it a rational choice, huh? Don't make it spontaneous, because, you know, setting a precedent for spontaneity is no good if you're not around for the next spontaneous impulse. Try exercise. Yeah, go out and take a walk, even in the cold weather. Bundle up. Walk to the store instead of driving there. Get your body working. And then maybe your mind will work better, too. Music. We've been playing a lot of music here. Music is good for the soul. Not necessarily all Amy Grant, all right? But music is good. Maybe not death metal. I'm sorry, folks, but death metal that suggests suicide, heavy metal rock music that suggests suicide, is not conducive here to continuing. In fact, I wonder